Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and me today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And, well, we asked the question on last week's pod, how on earth is the Chancellor going to pay for all this? Did we just get some of the answer this week? What, indeed, does a capital gains tax review really mean? Is it just a tax on homes and investors just after we got a cut to stamp duty? Talking of which, the team have spoken to the cladding prisoners, those homeowners for whom the cut won't make a difference. On the tax theme, why did Lloyds Bank think one This Is Money reader is a tax resident of Egypt when he's from Bromley? Is it a scam or just one big cock-up? Also today, we look at how you can use your money for good and what do all those recycling symbols mean. That might be a little bit tricky for a podcast, but if anyone can do it, we can. We also answer your questions about booking a trip abroad if you're brave enough or daft enough, as I appear to be, as I'm going away next week, fingers crossed. And we reveal the 10 cheapest cars to insure. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, last week, we mulled over how the Chancellor was going to pay for the huge pandemic bill. We speculated on which group or groups might be hit the hardest. Would it be the self-employed, pensioners or rich folk? Well, this week, the speculation is it could be homeowners and investors, though in all honesty, it's probably likely to be all of us in some way or another. But why these two particularly? It is because the Chancellor has ordered an urgent capital gains tax review. But firstly, Simon, welcome. Bit of an economics 101. What is capital gains tax?
A capital gains tax is a tax that you pay when you make a profit on an asset that you sell. There are some assets that are exempt, but the main ones that we're talking about here are shares, fund investments, property if it's not your own home, so second homes, buy-to-lets, and a business. If you build a business over the years and then you sell up, you'll pay capital gains tax on your profits. Among the things that are exempt are things like classic cars, wine, art sometimes, although there can be a bit of a grey area with some of this stuff, because if you're considered to effectively be dealing or trading in these things, then you could find that the taxman comes knocking at your door. And it's charged at a lower rate than income tax. So there are two rates. You have 10% for a basic rate taxpayer, and you have 20% for a higher or additional rate taxpayer. And it's only charged on the amount that you make above an annual exempt amount of £12,300. Now, while that 10% might sound exceptionally generous, you have to remember that there is a nasty little quirk of the tax system here, thanks to a previous Chancellor, Mr. George Osborne, where you add your capital gain onto your normal income, which then decides what level of capital gains tax you pay. Now, these are two completely separate taxes, but what it means effectively is that if you are somebody who makes £30,000 a year, and you then make a taxable gain of another £30,000, you won't pay 10% on all of that. You'll end up paying more on the amount above £50,000, which is where the higher rate tax limit kicks in. Most people will be thinking, that's a huge amount of money. I'm never going to make that amount. Where that really affects people is buy-to-let landlords or second homeowners who've owned stuff for a long time, or people who've built up very big investment pots. But people who've built up big investment pots can choose to kind of drip sell their assets, whereas those who are selling a property can't do that. It's all or nothing. Those who are selling a property that isn't their main home also face a higher rate of tax. And this is to sort of crack down on those wicked buy-to-let investors. The rates they pay are 18% if they're a basic rate taxpayer and 28% if they're a higher rate taxpayer. Again, bear in mind, you've got to add the game to your income to decide what rate of tax that you're paying. If you are an entrepreneur and you're selling a business, you can benefit from something called entrepreneur's relief. That means that you pay a special rate of 10%. And that's to reward you for having built up a business over the years.
So what do we know then? Is this just an urgent review? In fact, it's called an urgent review. It makes it sound very important. But could it result in actually lower tax? Is this just a let's take a look because this is quite a confusing tax, or is this a can we take a look at this with a view to getting as much money as we can from it?
Well, the timing's interesting, isn't it? Last week we had Rishi's big summer splash where he spent lots and lots of money to help with the coronavirus recovery. And this week we mysteriously have him asking the Office of Tax Simplification to look into a tax. And so you might think maybe he is trying to raise some more money. And I think whenever the Chancellor or the Treasury asks for this kind of thing to be done, you would be naive to imagine that they're not. Capital gains tax is quite controversial because there are quite a lot of people who say that it should not be taxed at a lower rate than income. That's because money makes money. It's just rich people making more money. It's capitalism. And if you've got the capital, you can make more money. And then you get to pay a lower rate of tax on it. Unearned gains. However, the principle behind it being lower is to reward the fact that you are taking a risk and to acknowledge it as well, because your income, you're not necessarily taking the same risk with, certainly if it's employment income. Whereas with capital gains tax, you might make a profit, but you also might make a loss when you make an investment, as if you read the small print at the bottom of the adverts, you'll find. Now, if you do make a loss, you can offset that against a capital gains tax bill for any profits that you've made elsewhere. But you are still taking a risk. You might buy shares and they might go down. They might not go up. You might buy a property. House prices might fall. It might go down. You might start a business and you might never make any money and it might go bust. So to reflect the fact that you have taken a risk and also to try to encourage entrepreneurialism and investment, the rates are lower. But they are also lower for one very, very key reason, which is when the tax was reformed and the rates were cut in 2008, something called taper relief was axed. And taper relief rewarded long-term investment. The longer you held an asset for, the lower the rate of capital gains tax you would pay when you sold it. That was swept away with this idea of one simple single rate. So that's why you've got these lower rates. Now, interestingly, the Labour Party put in its manifesto that it wanted to raise capital gains tax rates to the same level as income tax, but it did introduce something that was a bit like that taper relief of years gone by, which is that you would only pay tax on gains above the risk-free rate of return. The risk-free rate of return was based on what you would have got from a UK government bond. And interestingly, actually, for someone who held an asset for a long time and made a big profit, you could pay less tax under that system. And when we did some digging into this, we discovered that that included potentially a buy-to-let landlord who'd bought a property and made £100,000 on it over 10 years would end up paying considerably less tax than they would do under the existing system.
Let's talk about the collateral damage. As you said, there are always winners, unintended winners in these things, and there's always unintended losers as well. I'm not suggesting they're losers because the Chancellor doesn't get the system. Just take a look at the self-employment scheme that was introduced to help in the wake of coronavirus. Are we going to have a situation like that? Are there going to be some groups particularly badly affected, perhaps?
Yeah, the biggest collateral damage opportunity here is something that I don't believe will ever happen. So at the moment, when you sell your home, i.e. the house you live in, your main residence, you don't pay any capital gains tax. Now, this is not because your own home just doesn't incur capital gains tax. It's because there's actually a specific relief for it. Now, you could remove that relief, and it could be that then you'd end up paying tax on the profit you made when you sold your own home. Some people have suggested this, and there is a suggestion that you should replace stamp duty with this, because stamp duty is effectively a tax that is paid on the profit that someone else is making from selling their home, because you pay it on the purchase price. I cannot see it ever happening. It would be the most unpopular thing any Chancellor could possibly do. I can see the front page headline now, a tax raid on our homes.
Well, no, we've already seen them. They were in there. That's what the newspapers were focusing on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I can't see this happening, even for a Chancellor who has been so popular in his first few months as Rishi, and in a Conservative government with a whacking great majority, it would be career suicide. So let's strike that one off the list of the possible. Yeah. The next bit of collateral damage are pensioners or people living off investments in retirement or coming up to retirement. Now, if you've got your money in a pension and you draw your money out, you will pay income tax rates on that money. You get a generous 25% tax-free, but above that, you'll pay income tax rates. If you've got it in an ISA, you won't pay any tax at all if you sell your investments or draw an income from your dividends. If you have just investments, then if you're selling those investments, which a lot of people do, then you will be liable for CGT. Or say you've built up a big investment pot and then you want to cash in a chunk of it to fund your retirement. And you might think, well, how much money are these people going to be making? But there are lots of people who have built up these big investment pots. And there are lots of people who don't necessarily have them in a SIP or an ISA because they've done it over a long time. It wasn't so easy to have a self-invested personal pension back in the day. And ISA limits used to be much, much lower. So they're a possibility. Entrepreneurs, I mean, I think that they are a potential target. This 10% rate that they get is controversial. Not because people don't believe in rewarding entrepreneurs, but because it's being used by limited company directors who roll money up into a business and then they then wind the business down, take the money out, pay the 10% tax rate. And this relief is thought of as a kind of a relief for people who've built a business, employed people and everything like that over the years. The argument is that some of the people using it don't, and they're kind of, they're using it as a way to dodge or avoid income tax. The lifetime limit on that's already been cut from 10 million to 1 million. So maybe it's safe. And then I think the other bit of collateral damage is the potential that we get a tax rise, but we don't get any of these reliefs brought back in, the taper relief. And that I think is the real risk for people. Because we've seen this happen with dividends. The dividend tax rate was raised and we got a bigger £5,000 tax-free dividend allowance. Then there was controversy about people paying themselves in dividends. So that gets cut to £2,000, but the rate of tax never comes down. And the people that's hurt is basically small investors and back to those pensioners as well. So who knows? I mean, you could find that the Office of Tax Simplification look at this and come back with a suggestion that makes it a much, much better tax and actually that quite a few people pay less, but yeah, who knows?
It might be indeed. Lee, just very briefly, I want to talk to you about perhaps a more holistic approach to this. The Chancellor is a very smart man who knows all about finance and business, but I'm wondering if the fact that a lot of the country don't, it might play in his favour. I don't mean that in a disparaging way. I mean it more as in a lot of the axe might fall on people like the self-employed, entrepreneurs and business. And it seems not a very conservative thing to do. But these seem to be slightly easier wins because, well, it's hard to explain them, basically. I mean, you can always explain a cut to your state pension or something like that.
Exactly, Georgie. But this is fiendishly complex. It's got more layers than an onion in a pasta parcel at a kids' party. I find it complicated to get my head around. And you're totally right there. And Rishi Sunak has sort of said in the last 24 hours that income tax, national insurance and VAT won't increase before 2024, which is part of the Tory manifesto.
I mean that as in, is politics going to have to play a part in this as well as economics, as it always does?
Yeah, I think it will. Look, this, anything that's going to attack CGT, I think, is going to face quite stiff opposition from backbenchers because those who pay CGT are twice as likely to pay higher rate tax as taxpayers than generally. So, you know, it is a bit of a hit on people that tend to, you know, have more wealth. And that is a very sort of anti-conservative kind of way of dealing with things. So I think you're totally right. It is complicated. Unless you really need to know about it, you probably don't know about it. You've probably not really sort of digested the rules and what it's all about. But one thing I will say, which I thought was quite interesting in the story that we had written by Tanya Jeffries, is about how much revenue CGT is forecast to bring in. And it's going to have risen fourfold between the financial year 2013-14 to 24-25 from 3.9 billion to 17 billion. If you compare that with alcohol duty and tobacco duty, it would surpass both of those, which alcohol duty forecasts are 13.9 billion, tobacco duty 8.7. So it's already raising quite a lot of money. How much more do they want from the CGT element for it? It's gone up fourfold in a decade, or it's forecast to go up fourfold in a decade. How much further can it go?
You say how much do they want? How much do they need? A lot.
£1 trillion.
£1 million. I just want to ask Lee, because talking about stamp duty, that is one change that we definitely had from the Chancellor that came in. But there is there's a section of people that this won't benefit. And I'm not talking here about first-time buyers or those outside of London and the South East, but another group altogether. And this is the cladding prisoners. What on earth is this about, Lee?
Well, this is a real difficult situation that people in high-rise flats and buildings that have had this aluminium cladding put on their buildings are facing. So what's happening is they're struggling to sell their flats and move out, mainly because people that want to buy them can't get lending. They can't get a mortgage from lenders because they're too nervy to lend on these properties because of the Grenfell disaster that happened. And now there's big arguments about this, about who's going to foot the bill over who's going to replace this cladding. It was used to improve appearances and for some green policies. But what's happened in recent years is that it feels like there's a lot of heel dragging at the moment between who's going to foot this bill. And the UN has actually warned Britain that its failure to strip this combustible cladding might be a breach of international law. But it keeps going and going and going. And we're hearing from lots of people that are basically trapped in these flats. They can't sell, they can't move out. And at the moment, the future is quite unknown. And the potential is they might end up having to pay a lot of money to chip in to get this removed. At the moment, quite a lot of flat people that live in these flats are having to pay for fire wardens, to make sure that something as tragic as Grenfell doesn't happen again. And it's a really difficult situation. There's believed to be 300 of these buildings across Britain. A lot of them are concentrated in London and the South East, but it's not a wholly London and South East problem. And what are you meant to do? These people are currently trapped without an end in sight. And there's been a lot of, talk about what's going to happen, but there's been what feels so far a very lack of action.
Simon?
Yeah, I think one of the big issues with this cladding thing, and I think that it is absolutely disgraceful that this is going on, some years down the line from the Grenfell Tower fire, is that basically, if you're one of the owners of one of these flats, and if you were one of the people who lived in Grenfell, okay, you trusted that somebody had done their job properly, and you trusted that the authorities were looking after you. You trusted that there were building standards that meant that you were protected, and that there were building standards that meant that your block had been built properly. And it's quite clear that with the amount of this combustible cladding, or potentially combustible cladding, or we don't even know if it's combustible cladding going on, and with the tragedy that happened at Grenfell, that was not what happened. Okay? And I think that it is an absolute disgrace that the government has not absolutely whipped this one through as quickly as possible, has pushed it and pushed it and pushed it and pushed it. For the people who suffered at Grenfell, for the people who lost family and friends and loved ones at Grenfell, and for all of the people who are having to live in these flats that, they don't know if they're safe, or actually in some cases they are safe, but they can't sell them or they can't move. Their lives are being having to put on hold because the freeholder of the building, okay, because these people don't actually own their own buildings. The freeholder of that building is not sorting the problem out. And I think that it is not fair to make these people wait, just as it's not fair not to deal with this problem in kind of memory of the people who died in Grenfell. And I think it is absolutely shocking that all these people put their trust in the system, and the system fundamentally let them down and has then continued to let them down. And there's such a huge amount of buck passing going on for anybody caught up in one of these situations. There's contractors, there's freeholders, there's housing associations, there's, and the residents associations are fighting an absolute mass of red tape. And it's just basically not good enough. And if the government had any sense, it would absolutely 100% pull its finger out and get this sorted. And I think it is an absolute disgrace.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And the purse is open at the moment, Chancellor. If we're spending all this money to save lives, well, let's spend a little bit more to save a few more lives as well.
Yeah, because I'll tell you what, the people who do the work to replace the, to take the cladding off and replace the cladding, when they get paid, they'll go out and spend that money. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I can agree with you. Keep us updated on that one, though. I'm going to turn our attention to an email that you had from a somewhat baffled and not a little concerned, as you might expect, reader of yours. Now, I'm just going to read this out. At the end of May, I received a letter, not me, your reader, claiming to be from Lloyds, my bank, saying they believe I have recently updated my details and that I'm now a tax resident of Egypt. It says if this is true, I need to confirm it by sending them a passport, ID, card, or other documentation proving I am indeed a resident of Egypt. I received a follow-up letter a month later, at the end of June, telling me I still hadn't signed it. I am in my mid-70s, am a British citizen, have lived in the UK for 74 years, including the same address in Bromley. I like Bromley very much. For the last 35 years, and have no links to Egypt. I am very worried about falling victim to a scam. Is this letter legitimate and do I have to fill it in? Lee, well, is it scam man voice or is it just a big cock up?
This one, I think, is the big niche interesting story of the week on our website when something quite unusual crops up. And quite often our best stories come from readers that write in and are kind of baffled by something that's happened. So first of all, this letter is legitimate. So banks do write to people and ask them to send in documents to show them who they are. And that can happen to people that have potentially been with the same bank for decades and perhaps been at the same address for decades. And it's often if you have dual citizenship or perhaps are from overseas. Now, what this is all about is part of something called the Common Reporting Standard, which was introduced a couple of years ago, which is designed to crack down on global tax evasion. So basically to make sure people aren't just hoarding money in UK bank accounts, which has come from, you know, overseas where it shouldn't have come from and that kind of thing. So that first part is that it's legitimate. And that is a good question because we have seen instances over the years in which banks, fraudsters have actually managed to send out letters with mastheads, genuine names of staff members from certain banks, and then sent them in the post, which feels like a bit of an old school method to scam people. But if they put on like the wrong telephone number on there and the letter that's legitimate, it's quite an easy way potentially to scam someone. Lloyds has turned around and said that this letter is legitimate. This person, I should add, is a British citizen, has no affiliation with Egypt whatsoever, other than a holiday 30 years ago to see the pyramids. So there's no connection whatsoever to Egypt. But this is what happened, and this is what Lloyds told us, which I just think is a classic computer cock-up. The area code for Bromley, which is in London, is +020. The international dining code for Egypt, it's +20, and someone had updated the details and must have knocked off the zero off of that. So the dialing code made it look like Egypt, and thus the person received a letter asking what their connection for tax reasons in Egypt. And our reader just couldn't get a simple answer to this, and it took us having to get in touch with them to find out what happened. It's basically just a digit had been removed from a phone number, and you can end up in Egypt.
Mistakes happen. This is worrying. Look, there is loads of scams we're reading about, particularly during this time.
And people should just tread with caution, exactly like this person did. You know, he didn't just think, oh, I've got to get my passport sent off. You know, obviously alarm bells rang because, you know, no affiliation to Egypt whatsoever. But if there wasn't that Egypt link, let's say it was something a little bit more sort of that might have caught you out. You know, some people might have panicked and thought, oh, you know, I don't, you know, been with the same bank for decades, don't want anything to happen to my money that's in there, and potentially might photocopy their passport and send it off or give over details to it to a call center, which has actually nothing to do with the bank in question. So my first thought with this, whether it's letter, email, text, just tread with caution, do your due diligence, think about it. Make sure you phone up the phone number on the back of your bank card and just find out what it's all about and see if it's a mistake or something that is legitimate. Way better to do that and spend a bit of time making sure that you're not going to fall victim to a scam.
Couldn't agree with you more. All right. A lot of people, so I hear, are thinking a lot more about the environment. I say so I hear, but I think I have a little bit more. I've certainly thought about investing and ethical companies and all that and buying less stuff, mainly because I have to. I was always a very keen recycler, I will say. And it's probably too soon to talk about it, even though lots of people are talking about what on earth is going to happen in life after lockdown. However, you know, we are seeing indications that consumer habits will change. Perhaps we will be kinder to people and to the environment and the planet. Let's hope so. But for all the best will in the world, recycling can be a little bit confusing. Let's go through this a little bit, shall we? First of all, are we actually any good at recycling in this country? I mean, pre-COVID, what sort of stats have we got? Because I don't know, it's quite confusing.
We're pretty good at recycling in this country. People themselves, if you look at regular polls, will say that they are very, very keen on recycling. One of the issues is that, as you said, a lot of people aren't entirely sure exactly what they can recycle. Mm. And what they should recycle. And so you get what's known as aspirational recyclers who will just put everything into the box. And I think that this is possibly encouraged by the fact that in most places in Britain, we don't separate out our recycling beyond perhaps paper from everything else. In many places, plastic, glass, sometimes even cardboard, tins, etc., all go into the same recycling box. And then they get sorted after the event. Whereas I remember going back 20, 25 years in France, you had individual bins that you had to, you had a one bin for your glass, one bin for your plastics, one bin for your cardboard, one bin for your normal waste and everything. So, and I think that helps because you get the customer to sort it. And it also encourages the consumer to think, well, yeah, my stuff is definitely being recycled rather than, it's all going in the same box and they say they sort it, but are they just chucking it out the back somewhere? Now, to give you a figure, the UK uses a massive 35.8 million plastic bottles every single day. How do we use that many plastic bottles every day? But only 19.8 million of these are recycled, which is just over half. Better than nothing. But big business doesn't help us out much. I think we should all know that we can recycle a plastic bottle, but from supermarkets using unnecessary packaging to giant consumer brands selling us, and this is a major bugbear of mine, crisps in bags that cannot be easily recycled. Honestly, right. It's just taking advantage of the consumer here. You know what this is? This is big business going, we can't be bothered. We just can't be asked to sort this out properly. Let's give it to them in the non-recyclable stuff rather than applying themselves. However, there's been an awful lot of pressure put onto companies in recent years, and they are doing a bit better, but they're not doing it quickly enough as far as I'm concerned. But in order to not be an aspirational recycler, and the problem with aspirational recyclers is that by putting in stuff that contaminates the recycling, you can actually mean that the other stuff can't be recycled. We have published our guide to the individual symbols. Now, I'm not going to really try to attempt this one over a podcast because I think this is definitely a visual medium here.
I'm
going to do is I'm going to stick a link to the story in the article for this podcast. Okay, so come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast where you will find that. But some of the stuff you get on packaging, widely recycled. Okay, that means packaging collected by 75% or more of local authorities across the UK, i.e. plastic bottles, very likely to be able to be recycled. Widely recycled rinse, again, recyclable, but please rinse it, get rid of any food residue. I would say just do that anyway with stuff. Don't put dirty stuff in the recycling. Rinse it out, guys, okay? The green dot. This symbol does not necessarily mean the packaging is recyclable, will be recycled, or has been recycled. It's just a symbol used on packaging in some European countries and signifies the producer has made a financial contribution towards the recovery and recycling of packaging in Europe. So it's made someone feel better somewhere down the line.
Excellent.
The Mobius loop. What is the Mobius loop, you ask me? It's those arrows that just keep going round in a loop. This indicates that an object is capable of being recycled, but not that the object has been recycled or will be accepted in all recycling collection systems. Sometimes it has a percentage in the middle to explain the packaging contains X percent of recycled material.
Capable, plastic. But it might not work. What a ridiculous thing to say. It might Maybe it might not. We don't know, but you know what? We can't say definitely no, so let's stick it on anyway. I mean, what a load of crap. Sorry.
Yeah, that sounds like it's I think it's the symbol. It's the symbol that you should wear on your T-shirt if you're an aspirational reciter. plastic resin codes. This identifies the type of plastic resin used to make the item by providing a resin identification code represented with a chasing arrow symbol surrounding a number between 1 and 7 that defines the resin used. How are you meant to use that as a consumer? I don't know. Glass. I think this one's obvious. Recycle it in the glass container.
Right, okay, good.
Yeah, okay.
You.
Waste electricals. Packaging with this symbol means that you should not place the electrical item in the general waste. They can instead be recycled through a number of channels. So I'd advise you to take your electricals down the tip and leave them in the electricals pile. They might just end up in landfill, but you've got a better chance of something being done with them. Right. Food waste, again, this is a big one. Most food waste, and if you just chuck it in the bin, it ends up in a landfill site, right? Well, what's wrong with that? It's food waste, isn't it? It's just going to break down. Well, it rots and it releases methane, and that is a damaging greenhouse gas. Okay, so this is why we want to put our food waste into the food waste bin. The reason why lots of people don't want to put their food waste in the food waste bin is because the food waste bin gets really mucky. So I've got two tips here. One, put a bit of newspaper inside it to line it. And two, get some of the food waste recycling bags that you can get. Like the little little compostable bags makes a massive difference to doing the food waste. It will totally change your attitude to doing food waste. And put the lid on properly. And if you've got one of them little locking handles, fold it down so that you don't get invaded by the foxes. What can't be recycled or what can't be recycled easily? A lot of stuff can be recycled, but it's just not that easy to do. Plastic bottles involved with chemicals in, don't chuck those in. Crisp packets, sweet wrappers, film lids from pots and trays, plastic toys and laminated pouches such as for cat food and coffee, not currently recyclable from home. Bathroom items, cotton wool, toothpaste tube, tissues, not recyclable from the home. Also, drinking glasses, wet wipes and plastic toys should also be put in a normal bin. If you're not sure if something's recyclable, check for the symbol. And if you don't understand it, Google it.
A kitchen towel can. It's sort of a bugbear between me and the other half. They'll put it in the recycling bin and I just keep taking it out. What's the final verdict? Because whatever you say, I'm not going to tell the truth if it's not me and I'm not right.
Look, Grace has written this wonderful article for us and she's not actually said what about kitchen towel. Okay,
so have a look.
We can do an ask an expert question from an anonymous reader who has asked us if she can recycle the kitchen towel. Potentially yes, but maybe not, and if it's really messy, no. Bad.
Yeah. Okay. All right. There's a reason I don't do food recycling, because the brown recycling bin that is for food outside my house has never actually been changed, ever. As in, they don't ever... there's nothing in it now. I've worked out that after over a year, nobody actually comes to pick it up. So it's pointless. But Lee, your views about all of this?
First of all, I just want to give a massive shout out to the bin men in the area around here who have done a fantastic job throughout lockdown and actually do a fantastic job in general. I live in a council.
And they entertained your daughter, no less.
They've entertained my daughter every Monday. Them. She knows when it's Monday because she stands at the window and she watches those bin men and they all wave and she loves it. And every Monday, even bank holidays, there's never any disruption in service. I think they're fantastic. And the reason why I mention that is because I live in Rochford District Council, which is the second highest recycling rate in the whole country, because they make it so simple. And I don't know why. I just get the feeling that some councils make it quite difficult. I think the overall recycling rate in Britain is just below 50%, and it's something like 63 or 65% around here. So, you know, that for that reason, you know, I thought I'd give them a shout out because they do a great job. The other thing I would say is that I took a top tip from Simon, and he told me this a little while back, and I've never recycled in the same way since, and that is to keep lids on when you put things in and recycling. Now, the reason why I'm saying that right now is that I had an iced coffee this morning, and I've got this foil packet here that I'm looking at, and it says flatten, and then it says dash cap on. And it says widely recycled at recycling points. Now, I believe Simon told me the reason for that is that if it's too small, it won't get recycled properly. So I keep the lids on now.
My wife went to a really interesting talk on recycling at one of the places she works, which sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it? Or a contradiction in terms. But actually, she said it was fascinating. And they talked to, it was someone who works in the recycling industry, and they talked about things like the aspirational recyclers and things. And my wife said she recognised a little bit of herself there, because I've often had to say to her, you can't put that in the recycling. But when it gets sifted, plastic bottles and stuff, and if you've taken the plastic bottle top off and you've put it in the recycling, the plastic bottle top won't get picked up by the machine that's doing the sifting. And I always thought I was doing the right thing and doing them a favor, like Lee just said, by taking the plastic bottle top off. But apparently you should leave the plastic bottle top on. So if you've got like a milk carton with the little green top on, then you leave that on the top.
There you go. Very good. Lee, I'd just like to point out, if you do want to do your bit for the environment, get yourself a little blender, make some coffee up, stick it in the blender with some ice and some milk, zhuzh it for about 15 seconds, and then you don't have any plastic waste at the end of it anyway.
Georgie, I would love to say that that's all brilliant, but I tell you what, sometimes when you've got a little toddler running around and you're trying to do I do make iced coffee sometimes, but it never tastes right. I can never quite get right. If there's any tips, please let me.
Here we go.
I've just made 2 points on this. Like, one, coffee should be drunk hot. Two, Lee, it's freezing outside. Why are you drinking iced coffee, mate?
Right, let's leave this, okay, because it is freezing outside, but it is hot where I'm going next week, fingers crossed. I don't know about you guys, but I'm getting loads of emails being sent to my inbox at the moment about adverts, about how cheap it is to travel from the likes of Expedia and EasyJet, Ryanair. Anyone would think there's no coronavirus at all and they've not sacked thousands and thousands of stuff. However, are cheap deals to be had when we're to go abroad, firstly? And yes, while it is tempting, are we complete fools for even wanting to go? Lee, am I a total idiot? Am I smart? Am I brave? Am I looking at this like this is an interesting time in history? And I'll look back and think, what an interesting moment I had going through an airport with a mask on, socially distanced, etc., etc., and being in another country with a mask on, very hot, and getting an amazing tan line across my face, no doubt. But anyway, I digress. Lee, lots of good deals at the moment. Would you be an absolute crazy fool to accept them?
Well, while we've been on air, I've actually received an email from Trailfinders, and they've got a whole host of BA flights to Europe for £50 return, which is very low for BA. They don't tend to kind of do short haul for that cheap. So that probably gives you an indication as to how they're trying to drum up some interest and some demand.
Can I just chip in there, though, ever so quickly? Because yes, a lot of the flights are cheaper. I'm always cynical about this. But do you not still have to put everything into hold, all your luggage? And that, to me, I notice, is extremely expensive. About £35 for one way. So you're looking at maybe £70, £60, £70 for a return journey, for your luggage.
That's the way travel's adapted, though, in recent decades, isn't it? There's a lot of people out there that are willing to go short haul, a couple of hours away, just to take on, you know, perhaps a city break, 3-4 days worth of clothes, in hand luggage, and go out there. And you're right, headline flight prices are never quite what you expect when you get through to the final basket. If you're looking to go away for a week and you need proper luggage, yeah, it's quite often more expensive than the flight in general. So yeah, no, you're totally right there. But there are a number of deals to be had at the moment, I would say. I think that trying to drum up people's interest to get out there and actually take the plunge is quite hard at the moment, and there's a couple of reasons for that. But firstly, I would say you're not daft for wanting to get away, Georgie. I think we're all having the same thoughts. We're all kind of thinking, should we book somewhere just on the off chance that, you know, the flight will go ahead and that the holiday will go ahead? But it's all about that kind of consumer confidence. And I think a lot of people at the moment are kind of treading lightly and watching the first wave of tourists from Britain head out into Europe and how that all pans out. Yeah. I watched a dispatch this week from Greece, which has reopened to British tourists, and they're doing random coronavirus checks on people from a computer algorithm. So you could be picked to have a coronavirus test when you arrive and get the results within 24 hours, because Greece hasn't suffered much from coronavirus whatsoever. So they're obviously keen to do that. But at the same time, the tourism industry out there has obviously been massively harmed. A large chunk of tourism does come from Britain in Greece. But then they had a shot of the beach and all of the sort of lounges and some of the hotels, and it was eerily quiet. I mean, it was incredible for mid-July, but of course it would be, because people, you know, have had holidays cancelled, and we're just at the beginning of all of this kind of reopening. I think that if you're going to book, there are a number of things, as we've mentioned before, that you want to kind of bear in mind. And one of the big ones for me, and one of the big ones I think that a lot of people kind of miss when they go to Europe, is they just solely rely on the European health insurance card. They think that that's the be all and end all, and that's going to cover them for you know, a whole raft of things. And I would say I wouldn't just rely on that at the moment. You need to be looking at what kind of insurance you can get. And of course, we've seen the insurance market being completely reduced. There are some insurers that are trickling back now, but like with anything, you've got to read all of the clauses and all the terms and conditions and make sure that, you know, you're getting the cover that you require. I would also, you know, there's quite a high possibility that flights could be cancelled. It's quite a high possibility that the hotel that you are intending to go to may get closed down.
We're seeing in Spain, lots of regions are being affected. You know, first it was Galicia, Catalonia, you know, it could be anywhere. Leicester here, this is moving so quickly, isn't it?
That's exactly it. So, you know, that's one thing that I would massively bear in mind. And I think for that reason, I do think a lot of people are kind of leaving it to the last minute and perhaps having a week booked off and thinking, well, let's see where the land lies a couple of days before. And perhaps a bit of a shift in consumer habits. I would say a lot of people like to know where they're heading quite far in advance, especially for summer holidays, because you have to lock them in quite early to get a good price, with, especially if you've got a family. I think it's a little bit been flipped on its head this year. So, I mean, we've got a week booked off in September. We haven't booked anywhere abroad yet, but we may do a day or two before and just take the plunge and go for it if we can get the right insurance. And, you know, that way I feel like it minimises risk a little bit, because you're kind of, you know, you kind of get a gauge when you're a bit nearer the time whether or not you're going to be able to take that holiday or not. And one of the big things is to make sure that you, if you, to get hold of insurance, is to make sure that you have coronavirus sort of clauses in there. Now, it's going to be very difficult to get an insurance policy where you're going to be able to cancel and get your money back with insurance. But I'm talking about if you did go on a holiday and you got coronavirus and you needed, you know, some expenses, or you needed to be flown home, or there's a whole raft of scenarios. If the hotel that you're in has to self-quarantine and then you've got to go to another hotel, all of those kind of things you need to consider. The risk. We've got a few friends that have booked flights recently in the last week, but most of our friends have parents that are living out in Spain, so that kind of risk is a bit minimal, because you know, they get on the flight and then you get there, and then, you know, you're not so worried about mixing with people in a hotel. You can just be in your family bubble. But you just want to make sure also that you're not going to be left out of pocket. So we've said this a few times on the podcast, wherever you're booking, just make sure that you're giving yourself as much added protection as possible. So, for example, if your flights are over 100 quid, definitely put them on a credit card. That's always a wise idea. If you're booking accommodation, check the cancellation policies. If you can get one that you can cancel 24 hours in advance, that's going to be massively helpful. All of those kind of things I would just be looking at and making sure that you are doing your due diligence and knowing that you're as covered as can be. And one of the other big things as well is about having insurance that covers you if an airline goes bust, because, you know, it's a tricky old time in the travel industry at the moment. And I would say that at the moment, it feels like there's no airline that's too big to fail. So I would make sure if you're getting insurance that you also have that cover in there as well.
It's funny, I've written about this in the past. Should you get that kind of cover? And, oh, well, it's up to you. It's quite rare, but it's happening more and more. And we've seen airlines fail more and more. And the advice has been, think about it. As to whether you'll be able to get things for coronavirus now on travel insurance, I think you'll be very unlikely. The sort of things that I looked at, I don't think I'm a complete fool, but I was looking at staying at hotels and Airbnbs, Lee, and I looked at it. But I decided that in the end, I don't want to fork out in advance a lot of money. So I'm actually going to be staying with friends. And I think it's easier if you have got friends and family, because then at least you think, well, it's just the cost of a flight to go out there. And I actually do have coronavirus cover on my travel insurance, because when it all started to kick off, the big advice was, for goodness sakes, get it. And I managed to get it as one of the final, I guess, people to be able to do it. So I have coronavirus cover. But yeah, I mean, I'm quite a short-term booker anyway, but it's changed me. I'm looking at, do you have cancellation policy? That's the first thing I'm looking at.
And it should be. And I think very few insurers at the moment are doing that. But if you've got an annual policy, I'm guessing it is what you've bought yourself for the year, and it has that protection, then, you know, I would still check with your insurer just to make sure that nothing has changed. The reason I say that is that if you're booking a trip now, it's a bit different to booking a trip earlier in the year before all of this kind of kicked off. I'm pretty certain that an insurer couldn't really wheedle their way out of it, but we know what the industry is like, Georgie. Yeah. So, you know, if you have an annual policy, before you book, I would just make sure, completely check the terms on it. And before you book any holiday, if you don't have an annual policy, you know, the best thing to do is always to book insurance, get insurance as soon as you book.
Interestingly, though, with some of this cover, so I've got a Nationwide current account that gives me travel insurance, and Nationwide updated their travel insurance stuff the other day. And I think it now tells me that I'm covered for a lot of stuff that I thought I might not be covered for. So initially there was a whole, like, basically anything before this date, you're not covered anymore. Now with restrictions lifting and the FCO advice now has changed from all but essential travel to all but essential travel with a list of exempt countries. So I'm not entirely sure where you stand on this, but for example, in the FAQs here, it says, if I book a trip, will I be covered for coronavirus? Your travel insurance will provide cover for events relating to COVID-19, such as emergency medical expenses abroad, cancelling or cutting short a trip, as long as you are not travelling against doctor's advice and the FCO were not advising against travel, both when you booked your trip and when you depart on your trip. Travel insurance will only cover you for circumstances you were not aware of when you booked the trip or were due to travel. In the example of going to a country where it's on that exempt list, the FCO advice has been lifted, and I don't have a doctor telling me not to travel, I think that tells me I'm covered. Mm-hmm. Says the same thing for medical expenses, and then has got some stuff around kind of cancellations. And I guess the risk for people is, like you said, if somewhere goes back into lockdown, whether it's locally or nationally, or the government suddenly changes its advice. But it does appear to be implying that if at the point when you booked your holiday to France, for example, you were allowed to go to France, the FCO advice had been lifted and it was on the exempt list, and the place in France that you were going didn't have a lockdown, and all of a sudden it becomes that you cannot go because that the place you're going has gone back into lockdown, France has gone back into lockdown, the government has changed your advice, then you would be covered for cancellation. But I'm just not entirely sure whether that is actually the case. It's definitely what it implies, and we're going to do a bit of digging into this. Because it is quite an interesting scenario, as you say.
All right, we'll leave holidays to one side and fingers crossed everybody's goes well. Mine. But we'll see. Finally, though, times are tough. People might be thinking, it'd be lovely to go on holiday if I could afford it. One of the big bills that we have to pay, sadly, motoring. So your motoring correspondent, Rob Hull, has been looking at the 10 cheapest cars to insure.
So the top 10 cheapest cars to insure reads like a list that you would expect would be the top 10 cheapest cars to insure. It's full of small kind of city cars, little runarounds and stuff, with the exception, I would suggest, of three vehicles on there that are real outliers. And one of the outliers on there is actually the cheapest car to insure, and that is a Mazda MX-5, which... it's not the kind of car that you'd think about being cheap to insure, because it's a small two-seater convertible. It's a sports car, basically. But the average premium for one of those is only £334.12. Now, what that does is it reflects the car and the kind of people who own them and drive them and what they're like, more than it reflects the actual risk of that vehicle. And it's because a lot of them will be used as kind of second cars, weekend cars. They tend to be maybe older, safer drivers who've splashed out on a bit of a fun car to have. They'll be more likely to be kept on a driveway or actually quite often in a garage, maybe doing lower miles and things like that. And that's why they're cheap. The other main outlier on this list is the Volkswagen California. That's our old friend, the camper van. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily expect those to be cheap to insure because they're not that cheap to buy. But again, low miles, don't get used that much. Probably not going to be used as your daily driver, not going down to the supermarket every day in it. And then the Land Rover Defender, again, average premium on that, £389.53. I'm not sure why those are considered so cheap, because you see them barreling around all over the place in the countryside and everything. But maybe because you're high up, you're safer, they get involved in less accidents, they're not that quick. You're not probably going to be using it to race anyone on the dual carriageway. And again, maybe they do tend to do those kind of lower miles and get looked after a bit better. But other than that, you've got lots of city cars and cheaper cars, Fiat 500C, Dacia Logan, Volkswagen Up, Seat Mi, Seat Arona, Skoda Citigo and the Skoda Yeti.
Well, I have to say that I pay nothing like those insurance prices, Lee, and I'm rather depressed from reading that article. What else can you do, though, legitimately to reduce your car insurance bill?
Before I go into that, can I just say that I've had my eyes on a Mazda MX-5, old school one, for a number of years. That and a Suzuki Jimny. I've always wanted one of those two cars. And I think given that the MX-5 now looks so cheap to insure, I may go on a little recce to buy one this year. The most anti-family car you could ever imagine.
But look, it's the insurance is a bargain.
It's a bargain. And if I can get a nice convertible one and just take it down South End Seafront, I feel like I'd be winning at life, feeling that wind sweeping through my hair as I whip down on my Mazda MX-5 in the most hideous colour I could possibly find. It's my dream. I'm going to do it one day. They're a bargain. I think they're great little cars. To reduce your car insurance outside of buying an MX-5, obviously the first thing to do is to shop around. We get taken for a ride in this country. The loyalty penalty is well documented. You get it through the letterbox, your annual renewal, and it quite often has gone up for absolutely zero reason. So make sure that you get some good quotes and you go back to your car insurer and you do the old classic yearly haggle with them to drive your costs down. When you go to buy a car, it makes a massive difference to insurance, as this article shows. So, you know, if you are in the market for a car, just do your homework and see, you know, if you're going to end up with some high performance car with a big engine and that kind of thing, you're going to end up paying more insurance. So bear that in mind. Get your mileage right. A lot of people might have overegged how many miles they might be driving. Just look back on your MOT history and see how many miles you've actually done and get an accurate reading for that. You want to build up your no claims, hopefully, if you don't have any accidents. You want to buy a car that's got plenty of security. You know, we've seen lots of examples in recent years of these keyless car thefts, for example. That's helping drive up premiums because people are having their cars nicked off the driveway. So good practice with that is to make sure that your key is somewhere that cannot have the signal read and relayed and then have the car stolen. So good security is key. And another common trap that people fall into is paying for their car insurance monthly rather than annually. If you pay it up front annually, you are likely to save a chunky amount on your insurance. So it is well worth doing that if you're able to.
Marvellous. Thank you very much, Lee. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to read all the articles around podcast past, join in the debate in reader comments, and see those recycling symbols that I was talking about earlier.
Yes, exactly. Although you did a fantastic job of describing them, Simon. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.